Hello, and welcome to Back. Tracks in Time. I'm Jack Sensabar, and my guest for this edition is Cindy LaPierre, a board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society. And today on this edition, we're going to be talking about the upcoming 200th anniversary of the Catskill Mountain House. So welcome, Cindy.
Thank you, Jack.
Cindy's been a couple of times before, so it's nice to see you again. So when she first told me it was the 200th anniversary, it threw me for a minute. Then I realized there was a smaller building up there at first in 1823, before the famous hotel that we were all familiar with. So, listen to now, I think the good way to start is talking about just the natural beauty of that area up there on Pine Orchard. Yeah. So,
thank you, Jack, because the natural beauty is what drew people to that area. And Charles Beach's father, Erastus Beach, owned a livery service in Catskill and sort of had the monopoly over transportation in Catskill and up on into the mountains. And he regularly took parties of people up to the Pine Orchard, which was the name of that spot that later became the Catskill Mountain House site.
Right.
And it was in doing that that he sort of got the idea that it would be good to have something there for travelers to rest, take refreshment, or even stay overnight. Okay, so before I get into how that developed, let me just read a little description by Washington Irving that comes at the very beginning of The Legend of Rip Van Winkle.
Okay.
I'm going to do it this way. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You can edit, right?
Yeah, well, it's all right.
Whoever has made the voyage up the Hudson must remember the Catskill Mountains. They are a dismembered branch of the great Appalachian family and are seen away to the west of the river, swelling up to a noble height and lording it over the surrounding country. Every change of season, every change of weather, indeed every hour of the day, produces some change in the magic hues and shapes of these mountains, and they are regarded by all the good wives far and near as perfect barometers. When the weather is fair and settled, they are clothed in blue and purple, and print their bold outlines on the clear evening sky. But sometimes, when the rest of the landscape is cloudless, they will gather a hood of gray vapors about their summits, which in the last rays of the setting sun will glow and light up like a crown of glory.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Okay. Yeah, that's
that is a perfect description.
And one of the interesting things about Washington Irving and writing about the Catskills is that at the time that he wrote Rip Van Winkle, he had never actually come into the Catskills. But his vivid imagination as he sailed by down on the Hudson River brought him in. And interestingly, the Legend of Rip Van Winkle still is seen everywhere in the Catskills.
Okay? I come across this bridge every day.
Exactly. Okay, now, in order to prepare for today, I did some going back through, especially the seminal book on the Catskill Mountain House, which is called The Catskill Mountain House, was written by Roland Van Zandt, who came into the area in the late 50s, early 60s. He had a home in Shandaken and saw the remnants of the Catskill Mountain House up there on the Pine Orchard. And he was absolutely fascinated. And so he started looking at some of the questions that we'll talk about some answers for today, like how did it come to be built? Who built it? How people got to it over the years? What they ate and drank when they were up there? What they thought and wrote about it? How it fell apart and ended up owned and burned down by the New York State DEC at 6 a.m. on the 25th of January in 1963.
Wow.
Okay, he spent years doing detailed research. He hiked the area, taking photos and interviewing people, combing archives, talking to local historians, tracking down prints, postcards, drawings, floor plans, going into the property records, immersing himself in the history and culture that surrounded the Catskill Mountain House for its 140 years in that spot on Pine Orchard.
He did his homework, that's for sure.
He did his homework. Okay, and how it came from humble beginnings to be one of the greatest hotels of the country. So the idea of having a place for visitors to stay overnight was inspired by day trips to the Pine Orchard by the Erastus Beach mm-hmm. with his livery, okay? He, in fact, was not one of the owners of the early Catskill Mountain House, but he helped organize a company called the Catskill Mountain Association, okay, even though he was not formally a member of that group. Mabel Parker Smith and Roland Van Zandt came to the conclusion that he didn't want to get into that part of the business. He was going to stick with the livery, which certainly kept him going well. Okay, so that Catskill Mountain Association mm-hmm. in 1823 built a shanty. Okay, it had bunks and straw for bedding. It was managed by Wilhelmus van Bergen, who leased and managed the first permanent building, okay, that was open, and then beyond that shanty, the first permanent building that opened in 1824. Okay, so the Beach family got into the Catskill Mountain House main building when Charles L. Beach mm-hmm. leased the building and started making the improvements that changed it from a federal style building to, you know, the beautiful
Corinthian
the beautiful palace with the Corinthian columns.
Right.
Okay. Everyone who lived below the mountain in Catskill and all along the Hudson River would look up,
yeah,
and that would be their sort of lodestone up there on the side of the mountain, on the Pine Orchard.
Well, I know where Charles Beach lived in Catskill, right at the top of Bridge Street across from St. Patrick's Church, and he said from his bedroom up in the upper part of the house, because he could look straight over at the mountains and see the mountain house.
So he knew it was still there every
yes,
morning. Every
right.
morning. Okay. Yeah. Yes, he could, and he built a equally beautiful house and home for his family down there in that spot okay. in Catskill.
Yes.
Okay. He said that his first visit to the Pine Orchard was at age 15 when he drove one of his father's coaches to the grand opening. Okay, the grand opening yep. of that shanty on July 4th, 1823. And the mountain house was the first of its kind in the country and considered one of the best. One of the best.
That's a pretty good reputation.
A pretty good reputation.
Yes.
It became part of the wealthier people from New York City and the East Coast when they did the grand tour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the stops was always the Catskill Mountain House. Okay, assuming they were willing to put up with what it took to get there.
Yes. Now, I was going to say, were there most of these visitors came from pretty much the city?
The city, the East Coast.
Okay.
I mean, the city, New York City at that time, and through the whole 140 years that the Catskill Mountain House was there, mm-hmm. okay, there was a larger population in New York City than in all of the large southern cities combined. Okay, so okay. Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, but mainly New York City. They were all coming up. And it was not an easy thing to do.
No.
Okay? And when it first opened, it was open right around the same time the Erie Canal opened, and right around the same time Robert Fulton mm-hmm. made a success of the steamboat. So the main way to get to the Catskill Mountain House from New York City was coming up the Hudson River on a steamboat.
Right.
And getting off in Catskill, okay, at the place mm-hmm. where you can still go to.
Right, there. Catskill Point.
Is that little museum still open?
Well, Dick Brooks, who ran it for many years, retired in 2016. And it stayed closed for a few years. This last summer, I was down there for some event, and I saw somebody sitting in there at the desk. So I don't know. I was told people, I wish I had the time. I would have done that in a heartbeat because I love talking to the people in there. But
yes,
yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
I do this, so it kind of works out nicely.
Works out nicely, Jack. Yeah. Thank you. But yes, for a long time, Dick Brooks, mm-hmm. who also wrote a column for the Windham Journal, still writes a column. Mm-hmm. For the Mountain Eagle.
That's great. Okay. Whittling away.
And who also taught history in Greenville
mm-hmm.
for years, would be there at the
historic River, Catskill Point. Well,
Riverkeepers.
Freightmasters Museum.
Freightmasters Museum at historic Catskill Point.
There
you can
go.
Still go to historic Catskill Point
yes.
and watch the ships come up and down the river.
I'm in there frequently in the summertime, sitting there and just watching. Yeah,
and the steamboats is like another whole side topic.
Right. Oh yeah.
Because the steamboats on the Hudson, well, they took over from the sloops. Originally, there were Hudson River sloops, but those were not really great for passenger travel. So the steamships. People knew the names of the steamships. There was the Great Mary Powell, and there was the Cotterskill, and there was
Antiora.
Antiora. There were so many of them.
Peter Stuyvesant, I think, was another one.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And they reached lengths of I have this number somewhere. 2,000 feet.
Wow.
No, maybe not that. Wait a minute. No. That would be ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah.
They were 400 feet long.
Okay.
But they could carry up to 5,000 passengers.
Right. I think somebody said more than, I think it was Dick that told me at one time, it's more than the Titanic.
There were, yeah, a lot of people. And they were coming from New York City to Catskill. They would get off the steamboat in Catskill and then get on a stagecoach. Well, now we'll talk about that in just a minute. But let me just go back to the steamships. The steamships would sometimes, the steamships would, the captains would get into these little competitions with each other
mm-hmm.
and race up the Hudson River. And there are stories of them running out of fuel as the steamships were coming up the river and starting to break up the furniture.
Oh, and, gosh.
You know, to keep it going. Anyway, I think I'm happy not to be going up on the steamboats under those conditions.
Yeah, I'm sure the passengers love this.
Okay. So when they would get to Catskill, Mr. Beach, Erastus Beach, and his family would greet them, okay, mm-hmm. And have stagecoaches ready for them to go on. Now, there's a broadsheet from the from the Catskill Mountain House that says, Mountain House Passenger Depot at Catskill Landing. Agent and assistants in attendance on the arrival of the Hudson. Oh, this was the railroad trains and the day boats. The stage fare was $2 from Catskill to the Catskill Mountain House at Pine Orchard. Okay. Oh, and it's Charles A. Beach's Mountain House Stages and Carriages.
Okay.
So it's no longer Erastus.
Right, by that time.
Okay, because this broadsheet is from 1880.
Okay. Yeah,
okay,
just
so
before the railroad.
Yeah, the Hudson River Railroads were probably just starting right after the Civil War.
Right.
We got the railroads coming up. But the stagecoach ride.
It was just a nice, comfortable ride
up
the mountain,
ride.
Right?
Well, it was 12 miles from Catskill Point to the top of the mountain at the Catskill Mountain House. Okay, mm-hmm. And the first 8 miles, 7 miles, was pretty flat. Okay, mm-hmm. You can, if you drive along Route 23A,
yep.
Okay, from Catskill toward the mountain road,
right.
Okay, it's pretty flat, no problems, mm-hmm. Everything's going great. And then you go through the toll gate and onto this rocky road with all kinds of S-turns in it and very narrow. And if you're from the city...
Mm-hmm. Might be getting a little frightened at this point.
I think you might be getting a little frightened at this point. And there was even a point at which most of the passengers would be asked to disembark from the stagecoaches because mm-hmm. It was too much for the horses.
Yes.
Okay, so... I mean, some of the passengers would choose to walk alongside the livery coach, okay? Others would be asked to walk alongside mm-hmm. the livery coach. And it was a noisy, rough, I mean, when you were in it, it was a noisy and rough ride.
Yeah.
So at some point, they were just grateful, I think, to get out. And walk, okay? Even though it was fairly steep.
Mm-hmm.
But after, you know, they were coming up for the scenery, and walking up steep paths was part of the scenery.
Starting already, I think after a journey like that, I need a few days just to recover from that once I got there.
Well, it's funny because among the people that wrote about their experiences, mm-hmm. some of them were horrified, and it was awful, and it took a while to get their composure back. When they got to the top. But actually, most of them, when they got to the top,
mm-hmm.
you know, they breathed that sigh of relief. Yeah. But then they looked around and they went, oh, wow.
Gorgeous.
This was worth it. Mm-hmm. This was definitely worth it. Okay, so, I don't, you know, there are letters on both sides of that one. But most of the people, or many of the people who came to the Mountain House, kept journals. Okay, so there are writings.
Mm-hmm.
Of how people reacted to that whole
adventure.
Okay.
Right. I think I don't know if it was in Van Zandt's book or somewhere, but even the horses, their flanks would be steaming by the time they got done.
Exactly. And that's even when people had gotten out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, their flanks were steaming. Oh, I think it was in his book.
Wow.
As well as in other places. Okay.
Okay. Well, we've come to the end of part one of this edition of Backtracks in Time. Again, my guest is Cindy LaPierre, board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society. And we're talking about the Catskill Mountain House. And we will continue in segment two. Thank you very much. and welcome to part two of this edition of Backtracks in Time. I'm Jack Sensabaugh, and my guest this month is Cindy LaPierre, a board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society, and we've been talking about the upcoming 200th anniversary of the Catskill Mountain House, one of our famous hotels here in the Catskills. And so in the first segment, we talked about the origin of the hotel, the beauty of the area. So now, look at my notes here. we were talking about the stagecoach ride up the mountain, and how kind of treacherous it was.
How treacherous it was.
Yes, easy
and
for
how
me to say.
Frightening, how frightening to those people coming up to this sublime place and picturesque place. Okay, but right now, they've got to get through this ride. And looking back at my notes, I see that I was a little bit off in terms of the distances. Okay, the trip from the Hudson River to the base of the mountains was 8 miles.
Okay.
And then it was a 4 mile climb from the base to the summit. Okay. Guess which one took the longest?
I would probably guess that 4 mile stretch.
Okay. Now, from at least 1826 until 1835, the coach fare from Catskill Landing to the Mountain House was $1. That $2 price tag I had given you was from 1880.
Okay.
So, okay, let's look at the inflation there.
Right. Yeah.
It's really amazing that those prices stay that close together. All right. And by 1880, when the history of stagecoaching was almost at an end, stages met every steamboat arriving from Albany and New York. And here's where the fare went up to $2.50. Okay. They did charge extra for trunks.
Oh.
So you had to leave your heavy trunk at home. Now, until the late 1870s, when the stagecoach travel was almost at an end, the coaches were large and cumbersome in the traditional manner of all American vehicular construction. Okay, here's a passenger talking about the coach during his 1827 trip to the Mountain House.
Okay.
Okay, an American stage is more like a French diligence than anything else. Like that vehicle, it carries no outside passengers except one or two on the box. It has three seats inside, two of which are similar to the front and back seats of an English coach, while the third is placed across the middle from window to window, or I might say from door to door. Only these stages very seldom have more than one door. Instead of panels, there hang from the roof leather curtains, which when buttoned down render it a closed carriage, or when rolled up and fastened by straps and buttons to the roof, leave it open all around. This for summer traveling is agreeable enough, but how the passengers manage in the severe winters of the north, I do not know, for certainly we found it on many occasions, even in the south, uncomfortably cold. The middle seat is movable on a sort of hinge that it may be turned horizontally out of the way when the door is opened. The three passengers who sit upon it rest their backs against a stuffed leathern strap permanently buckled to one side of the carriage and attached to the other side by means of a stout iron hook. These ponderous stages are supported on strong hide straps in place of steel springs, and all parts are made of great strength, which is absolutely necessary to enable them to bear the dreadful joltings on the miserable roads they have but too frequently the fate to travel over. Okay, so the other thing about these coaches is that everything rattled and clanged and clattered. To the ears of the driver, it was one long, wearisome din, but the sounds hedged in by woods and ravines made music as they rose straight up in welcome greeting to the ears of the eager company on the Mountain House verandas, for the stage also carried the mail.
Oh,
okay,
man.
So that's, but now I'd like to give the ending to that.
Okay.
This is Elizabeth Ellet, who did a lot of writing in journals and made her way into Roland Van Zandt's book a number of times. But here's what she said. The diverse beauty of Cottesgill Clove was almost inexpressible. Surprise and delight at the wondrous scene accompanying you on every step onward. The mountains rise abruptly on either side, almost to the clouds. The primeval forest is around you, and the depth of the gorge, which is sometimes narrow and cavernous, is filled by a brawling mountain stream, the same Carterskill that takes the leap down the falls above. For 2 or 3 miles, this scene of beauty and grandeur, varying at every moment, meets your eye. Now the stream runs over its bed of rocks, now dashes wildly in rapids, now runs smoothly for a space, while the road winds on its verge, sometimes far above it, sometimes descending nearly to its level. Anyway, it was worth the trip.
Yeah.
In other words.
Yeah. Well, for the success it was, people were willing to put up with all of that.
Exactly. Okay. So now.
So now the building itself. I mean,
oh,
it was
the
quite,
building itself. Okay.
It went through a couple of configurations, I know.
There were a number of configurations. I mean, it started out that first building that they put up,
yeah,
that they called the shanty, mm-hmm, in 1823, was by the following summer in 1824, okay, the association had built a Federalist building. Mm-hmm. You know, it was white. It was 3 stories high. Okay. It had, you know, the square columns, mm-hmm, that went with the Federalist style, but it was still that beautiful white building on the Pine Orchard that could be seen from the entire Hudson Valley. Right. So it was already, you know, getting into the minds and hearts of the people in the valley looking up to see it. I already said this, but we're going to find it again.
Okay.
In 18...
I know we mentioned
1839. 1839.
Before.
Thank you, Jack.
You're welcome.
Okay. Charles L. Beach leased the Catskill Mountain House, mm-hmm, from the Catskill Mountain Association, and he purchased it in 1845. But even when he leased it, he started making improvements, mm-hmm, additions, making it into the what some people call the Yankee Palace up there on Pine Orchard. But it was, he had obviously a good eye for design. Mm-hmm. He made luxurious rooms, luxurious parlors, and the piazza across the front with the 13 Corinthian
piazza,
columns.
Yeah.
Okay, the 13 Corinthian columns were, there's a couple of stories, but one story is that they were ordered by a church in the South.
Oh, okay.
That ended up either not being able to afford them or not being able to use them. So Charles Beach jumped into the breach and purchased them and put them along the front, and he had 4 additional ones that he used at what was the entrance to the Catskill Mountain House. When the carriages came up the road,
oh, okay,
they didn't come out to the front where the piazza was.
Mm-hmm.
They came in on the side, on the probably the south wing.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to check that out before I leave you with that piece of information being incorrect. But there were 4 that matched the front that were over, mm-hmm, on the side where people came into the lobby.
Yeah.
You know, for signing and getting their bags carried up to their rooms.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, as it grew and was improved, they've got all these people coming because of the advertising, mm-hmm, but they've also got people coming because of the work of the writers.
Yeah, we have some famous
okay, they've
visitors.
Read now. Now they've read James Fenimore Cooper,
mm-hmm,
and they've read Natty Bumppo's description of the view from the Pine Orchard, in which he could see all creation. Okay, all creation.
Yeah.
And they've read Washington Irving's Rip Van Winkle, with his description of that area up there in the mountains that he'd never seen. And in addition to that, Thomas Cole and other painters that were now called the Hudson River School painters, okay, had come up into the mountains, okay, right at the very early part of the Catskill Mountain House being built. They're one of the ones that use that shanty, you know, for staying overnight.
Right.
But then as the Catskill Mountain House became a little more grand and a little more expensive,
mm-hmm.
they looked for, you know, boarding houses down in Palinville or, you know, in Haines Falls that wouldn't cost these poor artists so much money.
Starving artists.
So, yeah. Some of them did really well. Take a look. If we look at Frederick Church and we look at Olana across the river, okay, Frederick Church was a student of Thomas Cole.
Mm-hmm.
But now Thomas Cole's first painting of the area around the Catskill Mountain House was Lake with Dead Trees, okay, which was done in 1825. And what he did was he took that painting and other paintings and drawings that he did up here in the area to New York City and displayed them in his New York City studio. And so people are now coming. This was the best advertising in the world.
Sure.
People are coming in and saying, I want to go there. And so they're making their way on the steamboats and onto the livery up to the Mountain House. It was amazing. Okay,
yes.
Now then there's Thomas Cole, Frederick Church, Asher B. Durand, Kensett.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, more, and there's more. All right, but let me also read to you a poem about the falls from William Cullen Bryant, okay, who was the poet that was most in tune with the romantic notions. All right. William Cullen Bryant, who became a good friend of Thomas Cole, and is in fact immortalized with Thomas Cole in a painting by Asher B. Durand called Kindred Spirits, mm-hmm. that I think, well, maybe everybody doesn't know, but is one to look up. Here is Durant's poem about Cotterskill Falls. Midst greens and shades, the Cotterskill leaps from the cliffs where the wood flower clings. All summer he moistens his verdant steps with the sweet light spray of the mountain springs, and he shakes the woods on the mountainside when they drip with the rains of autumn tide. But when, in the forest bare and old, the blast of December calls, he builds in the starlight clear and cold a palace of ice where his torrent falls, with turret and arch and fretwork fair, and pillars blue as the summer air. For whom are these glorious chambers wrought in the cold and cloudless night? Is there neither spirit nor motion of thought in form so lovely and hues so bright? Hear what the gray-haired woodmen tell of this wild stream and its rocky dell.
Wow.
Anyway.
These incredible descriptions of that place.
Incredible descriptions. Okay, and there are more, and there's more. Thomas Cole did a lot of writing about this whole romantic place.
Mm-hmm.
He actually lived in Catskill.
Yep, right near me, actually.
Aha.
Yeah, it's right around the corner.
On the farm that was owned by his in-laws, his parents-in-law. Now it's the Thomas Cole House, and people are welcome to go and visit and check out the whatever exhibits are on each year. There's some different stuff, and they keep adding, and they've now opened his studio, okay, as a part of the museum to visit. So that's really pretty cool.
It is.
But he was, Thomas Cole and William Cullen Bryant were very close friends, and they both had this sort of religious view.
Mm-hmm.
of the beauty of the area, and it was like their church.
Yeah.
And they and their paintings and their poems were their worship of mm-hmm. this amazing place. And you know, the romantic wildness of America and as seen differently from what was still called wildness in the old world. Okay. This is the beginning of the wild American spirit. Now, it's interesting because Charles Beach subscribed to that religion as well.
Yes, he did.
William Cullen Bryant, Thomas Cole, a number of the other artists and writers. And so things like the trains, which we're going to talk about, because the trains came in after the Civil War.
Right.
And from Beach's point of view, from Thomas Cole's point of view, I think Thomas Cole was gone by then.
Yeah, he's like 1848. Yeah.
But the artist's point of view was that those were intrusions, okay?
On the nature,
On nature. But at the same, it's interesting. So this industrialization, which is happening, these trains, which are intruding on the natural scenery, were actually, they're making it easier for people to get there.
Right. That's true.
Okay. But
it seems to have like an opposite effect.
It had what Roland Van Zandt notes in his book is that as it got easier for people to get up there, because now with the trains from New York City and into the mountains,
right,
they could be there, you know, in less than a day. All right.
Yeah.
When in the steamboat days, they were talking about an overnight on the steamboat, and then the grueling 8, 10, 12 hours up the mountain. No, not 12 hours, but eight miles
up the mountain.
12 miles, which was
Catskill to the mountain to the mountain house.
Into the mountains. So anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk about what they did besides take in the scenery.
But yeah, we have about maybe 3 minutes or so left in this segment. Do you want to talk about a little bit about the activities for the guests?
Yeah,
we can always continue on at the beginning of the next one if we have to.
Yeah, that's fine.
They had an interesting way of being woken up in the morning.
Oh. Oh, yeah, Charles Beach.
Yes.
Charles L. Beach had some rigid ways about him. And one of them was that the guests at his hotel, no matter what time they finished partying the night before, or what time they got in the night before, because frequently that was the thing that made them tired the next morning, was that they needed to be wakened in time for the sunrise. Now, in the summer, which is when the mountain house was at its height, okay,
right,
the sunrise was between 4 and 5 a.m. So the bells would ring, and people that worked at the hotel would be banging pails and making sure that everybody woke up.
Oh,
but there
gosh.
were the special rooms that were on the front, or on the, I shouldn't say the front because that's not really the front, the piazza side.
Yeah.
Of the building, looking through the Corinthian columns, there were people who could lie in their beds and look out and watch the sunrise.
The lucky ones.
The lucky ones. Okay.
I have to get up at 6 a.m. in the morning. I don't even like that. Because especially this time of year when it's so dark.
When it's dark,
oh,
right?
I hate that.
Okay. So, he did that. And then there were things that the Catskill Mountain House offered, okay, like a telegraph office, a post office, a little bit into Charles L. Beach's time, they had a resident physician, long-distance telephone, and a full range of activities. Boating on North and South Lake, bathing in North and South Lake, fishing, mountain climbing, golf, tennis. You can see in some old photos croquet being played. Just walking around. Carriage rides, the beach livery had carriage roads to take people to Cartersville Falls, take people all around the area to see the beauty. Yeah. A lot of the roads and trails that are still up there at North South Lake State Park were built for the people that came to the Catskill Mountain House and maintained for the people that came to the Catskill Mountain House. So fortunately, you know, when that area was did in fact become the property of New York State DEC, those things were improved and used, and you can go there and walk in those walks. You can't, they don't have the carriage rides.
No, not anymore.
but you can walk, you know, you can walk, you can go to North Lake and then head up toward North Point along the Escarpment Trail that way. You can go south around Inspiration Point and Layman's Monument and see all the best views in the Catskill Mountains. They also had music and dancing.
I know they had a ballroom in there. They had a bowling alley.
They did have a bowling alley. Okay. I mean, I've seen pictures of the bowling alley in the Hotel Cartersville. Have we got time to go
into
that?
We'll do that in the beginning of the next segment. Yeah.
In the next segment. Okay. I've seen the picture of the bowling alley in the Hotel Cartersville. I believe they did have one.
Oh, okay.
At the Catskill Mountain House as well. Okay. All kinds of things. And I think, you know, there would be carriage rides, you know, to take people into town.
Mm-hmm.
Into town.
Town, right, yeah.
Haines Falls.
Right. Yeah. The bustling metropolis.
Okay. Well, interestingly, by the time we got to the end of the Civil War and the railroads had been, you know, they've been building railroads through the Civil War. Okay, so now we're in the 1870s and those railroads can help get get people up here. The original passenger lines went from Weehawken in New Jersey up on the west side of the river. Okay, now the passenger lines are all on the east side of the river. Mm-hmm. That's where the Amtrak is.
Right.
But they originated from Weehawken and up to Kingston.
Yeah, the West Shore Railroad, I think.
The West Shore Railroad. And Kingston, Catskill, and then in Catskill, even though Mr. Beach wasn't thrilled about it, he ended up building a railroad from Catskill to Palenville, which later made it all the way to Tannersville. It was called the Catskill and Tannersville.
Right, yeah, it was like three segments. The Catskill Mountain Railway was the bottom part. And then
right. Yes, and he engaged the man who designed the elevator for the Eiffel Tower to build a funicular.
Yes, Otis.
The Otis Elevating Railway, which, you know, as you're driving on 23A west, you can look up and you still see that slash, okay, that a lot of people weren't thrilled about.
Especially Beach, yeah.
When it happened, especially Beach. But it's still, he had a steam-driven funicular that you would get on in Palenville, and it would take you in 7 minutes to the top of the mountain, okay?
Yeah.
To walk right over to the Catskill Mountain House. So considering the jarring ride that you had to take on the stagecoach to get up there, this was wonderful. One woman described it as, it felt like I was going to the moon.
Was her name Alice Crampton? I had to do it. To the moon, Alice.
To the moon.
So I had to do it. I got to get one joking at least every show.
Yeah, no, that's good. And Jules Verne, to the moon, right?
Right.
Anyway, we're good?
Yeah, we're good. Okay. So, again, you're listening to Backtracks in Time. My guest is Cindy LaPierre, of the board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society, and we've been talking about the Catskill Mountain House on its upcoming 200th anniversary. So in our next segment, we'll talk a little more into the declining years, the sad declining years of this once grand hotel. Okay, so thank you very much for listening, and join us for part three. Thank you. Welcome to Backtracks in Time. My name is Jack Sensabar, and my guest is Cindy LaPierre, a board member of the Mountaintop Historical Society. And in our first two segments of this edition of Backtracks, we've been talking about the upcoming 200th anniversary of the Catskill Mountain House Hotel and the history of it. And in this segment, we can finish the last segment talking about some of the activities that were offered there. We'll just continue on with that now and then go into the unfortunate, sad, declining years of the hotel. So we were talking about some of the activities they had, such as hiking and swimming and so forth. Now, Sundays there were a little bit different.
Sundays were very traditional. And even though I had said earlier that, you know, Charles Beach and Thomas Cole and a number of the writers, William Cullen Bryant, saw, you know, nature as sort of their religion. Right. There was also the rigid part of Charles Beach, and Sunday was taken up with lots of church services, singing, sermons. But, I mean, it was in a beautiful spot.
So, right, you can't get any better than that.
So it kind
of a cathedral.
kind of brings everything together. You know, and in a way, his waking everyone up for the viewing of the sunrise, you know, kind of goes along those same lines. They couldn't miss the sunrise while they were there.
Right.
All right. Now, during this time period, we're talking from 1824 to 1880, okay, the Catskill Mountain House was the place to be. And it didn't have a lot of competition, okay? It was sort of the palace on the mountain that everyone was going to go to. And then something happened in 1880 to change that. There was a gentleman from Philadelphia named George Harding. He was a lawyer and a gentleman, but he had come for years to the Catskill Mountain House. He knew Charles Beach well. And then one summer, his wife and or daughter, there's a little, it's one of those things that has passed into legend and no one knows exactly what the circumstances. But something happened where George Harding requested that spring chicken be served for his wife and daughter. Well, spring chicken wasn't on the menu that evening. So Charles Beach said, no, I'm sorry, we can't take care of that. And apparently the discussion went through, you know, those levels of getting a little more heated and a little more heated and a little more heated until the last thing that Charles Beach said to George Harding was, if you don't like what's on the menu, if you want chicken on the menu, you can build your own hotel.
And open mouth, insert foot.
And put chicken on the menu whenever you want. Okay, so unfortunately for Charles Beach, well, didn't work out badly in the end, but unfortunately for right. Charles Beach, George Harding had the means to do exactly that. And within a year, okay, he built the largest wood structure in the world, in the country. I mean, it was a huge hotel. And it was only a mile, 2 miles away from the Catskill Mountain House. The Catskill Mountain House was on North Mountain. The Hotel Cotterskill, which was built by George Harding, was one or two miles away on South Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was built in a year. It was open in a year. And it had rooms for 1,000 guests. The Catskill Mountain House usually accommodated about 500 guests at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about twice as big. The footprint of the Hotel Cotterskill is 1 mile around. You can go up there. You can go there and walk the footprint. And it was a mile around. It didn't have quite the view that the Catskill Mountain House had. The Catskill Mountain House had the premier view, but it was amazing. Okay, that he had crews. He built it over the winter from 81 to 82.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that opened. I think it's opened in 82. Could Sounds be 81.
Right. Yeah,
it's right around
I'm
there.
A little,
but it was a year. It wasn't totally finished. There was an additional annex that was added on at a later date. If you look at the photos of this place, there are specific photos where you can see the guy wires, the cables that were run along the sides of it so that as the winds came across there, the hotel wouldn't be blown off the mountain immediately.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, it's truly mind-boggling. But he did so. George Harding did well.
Mm-hmm.
And George Harding had a good friend in the railroad business. Kirkendall from Kingston, okay, ended up bringing the Ulster and Delaware Railroad up from Kingston to Phoenicia. And Phoenicia, they pushed through the Stony Clove and Cotterskill Railroad up to Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
In Hunter, it divided into two parts, and one of those went east right to the back door of the Hotel Cotterskill on South Lake at the Cotterskill Station. So that kind of put Charles Beach in a little bit of a bind. Okay, for a while he had an agreement with George Harding, believe it or not, they had an agreement. And, you know, the passengers for the Catskill Mountain House could come up to the Cotterskill Station and then be transported up to the Catskill Mountain House. But that didn't last all that long. So what Charles Beach did was first he had to build the Catskill and Tannersville Railroad, except it didn't go to Tannersville yet. It was a narrow gauge line, went to Palinville. In Palinville, you got off of that and got on to this wonderful funicular. I think I mentioned the funicular.
Yeah, the Otis Elevating Railway.
The Otis Elevating Railway. 7 minutes from the bottom to the top. And it felt like going to the moon.
Yeah.
But that sort of meant that the Catskill Mountain House had the same access by rail that the Hotel Cotterskill did. Okay.
Right, something Beach had to be kind of be forced into.
Yeah, I was going to say that was not his cup of tea, but he had to give in to the industrialization at that point. And the end of the story is that in 1924. I'm back in the wrong century. 1924, thank you. the Hotel Cotterskill burned down.
Yes.
In the fall. Okay. Accidentally burned down. The help was there getting things closed up for the winter. And according to, again, some of this stuff is lore, there were a few people that were employees who were getting the hotel buttoned up for the winter were making soap.
Yep, from the grease.
Okay, and soap, lye, fat, okay, it caught on fire. The building was a totally framed building. Okay, it caught fire and it burned ferociously.
Yeah.
Okay, there was a gentleman who was on the board of directors at the Mountaintop Historical Society, whose family had a home in Haines Falls. Yeah. And he was about 5 years old when that happened. He remembers seeing the fire of the Hotel Cotterskill, which was seen over into the Berkshires, down the Hudson Valley, up to Albany. I mean, this huge building, you know, burning amazingly fast.
Yes.
Amazingly fast.
I think I remember, I've got like a little booklet on what happened that night. And it says that, if I'm an eyewitness, or it might be the same person, I'm not sure, says that a firefighting system had been installed in the hotel the year before, but when the thing caught fire, the employees just ran out, and they said you could see some of the employees throwing their belongings out the windows. And so much for activating the firefighting system.
So much for the firefighting system.
And the hose company one at that time of Catskill started up the mountain and realized the futility of the trip and turned around and came back.
Right.
Yeah, no point.
There was nothing. Well, the next morning, the photos from the next morning, there's this whole metal thing that had been the bridge between the main building and the annex. You can see that crumpled up, you know, down there. But nothing left. Lots of crockery left.
Yeah.
Okay, and Justine Hummel, you know, who was the historian for Catskill and one of the founders of the Mountaintop Historical Society, said all this crockery. So, I mean, people were going up and, you know, finding stuff. There's stuff that was found. Interestingly, even now, if you go to the Hotel Cotterskill site, you can find bits and pieces. You're not finding whole crockery anymore.
No.
That is long gone.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a section where one of the towers that housed the modern bathrooms that they had in the Hotel Cotterskill, and there's lots of crockery from sinks, bathtubs, toilets.
I knew that was coming, yeah.
Okay, that, you know, you can still find there. I mean, it's not something you're going to want to walk away with, but it's you can see how fast and what that whole thing was like.
That was a shame, though, you know.
But
still.
It was a shame.
Yeah.
It was a shame. George Harding was no longer around. Beginning in 1924, which was the year that the Cotterskill burned down at 43 years old, okay, there were already signs of the decline for the Catskill Mountain House. Management was now John K. Van Wagenen, who was the husband of Mary L. Beach, the granddaughter of Charles L. Beach. Mm-hmm. Okay, life at the resort still supported all the services that they'd had there, and thousands of sightseers still came by automobile to admire the world-famous view. But the mood and the tone were already altered. We'd gone through the Depression, the decline in the number of fashionable people who did not return the following year after 1924 was 200. So they went from 500 guests to 300 guests in that year. And then they didn't have the money to keep the expansions going, to keep the improvements going. So by the time they reached their 100th anniversary, things were already on the downhill.
Yeah.
So in June of 1920, a partnership between Milo Claude Mosman, who was a lawyer in Tannersville, who was a banker in Tannersville, and Lyle Gardner, who was a lawyer in Tannersville, bought out the remaining Beach family, Louis J. and Charles T. Beach.
Mm-hmm.
They needed to sell to reduce their land holdings, and they kept one-fifth of what had been the empire of the Catskill Mountain House. So that was the end of the beaches. Okay. Now by June 11th of 1930, the major part of the CMH Park, Catskill Mountain House Park, we okay?
Yeah, we're good.
Was purchased by the state of New York by the Department of Environmental Conservation and added to the property that they had already bought from the Hotel Cotterskill. So now they had 2,197 acres of the finest recreation spots in the entire Catskill region. So the state marked and improved the old trails of the mountain house, built a public campsite along North Lake, and a caretaker's cottage. I think that Charles L. Beach would have smiled.
Yeah, he probably would.
At this turn
have.
Of events.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I don't think he would have smiled a few years later, but the hotel continued to function through the 30s, okay, by leasing it to some brothers named Andron, and it was run as from 1932 to 1942 as Andron's Mountain House. Mm-hmm. It was a kosher hotel at that time, okay? But in 42, they did not renew their lease. And Mosman, who really believed he could get this place going, didn't open it that year. So 1943 was the first year that the building remained shuttered and wasn't opened. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, Roland Van Zandt said it was as if the Catskills had lost their soul. It was like, so Mosman is still determined. He's a dreamer.
Yeah.
Okay, and he believes he can save the building. And so he sold off the two wings. There was a south wing and a north wing, or east wing and a west wing, whatever, to a salvage company who came in and tore it down and salvaged what they could from there. And he was going to use that money to restore the main house.
So the oldest part of it,
He finally ended up, he was constantly being courted by the New York State DEC, but he knew that because of the state law, selling to them meant that the house would be destroyed. Mm-hmm. So he held off and he held off and he held off. And so he sold to a group called the Carpathia Vacation Camp Company, who ended up selling to the DEC because they couldn't make it go either.
Yeah.
And Mosman died in 1958.
He sounds like he made a valiant effort. He tried, but
he
just...
He made a valiant effort. So the New York State DEC acquired the property from the Carpathian Vacation Camp Company, and the curtain fell. So that was the end of that. There were... there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. I mean, there had been a number of drives to try to get people interested and try to get... It just didn't work.
Yeah. So how... just quick, how did the state get rid of the building?
Well, on January 25th, 1963, in the dark, at 6 in the morning, a group of people from DEC and local fire groups were there, but it was, they did it early in the morning in the middle of winter, you know, so that there'd be no problems with burning down the forest or anything like that.
Good point.
But there was a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think a lot of people just, like Roland Van Zandt said, it was like the Catskills had lost their soul.
Yeah, that'd be a shock when they woke up in the morning and looked at that.
Right. People for 140 years had seen that every morning, every afternoon.
Yeah.
It was there. It was one of the constants in their life.
And all of a sudden, it's gone.
That's gone. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, can I throw in a little plug here?
Okay.
Quick one.
Yeah.
And you can do with it. I mean, Dee Thorpe. Has just put together a book called Tidbits of the Town of Hunter.
Okay.
And she's now the historian for the Town of Hunter.
Okay.
And she's been working hard at organizing, like, newspaper articles and various things related to the history. And that will be going on sale probably in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And watch. It'll be on the web. The information on how to order it will be on the website.
Okay, so if somebody's interested in that, they can go on the website of the
mtmhs.org.
Okay.
Okay.
That would be great.
Okay.
I'm going to try to have Dee Dee on again pretty soon, too. She was on a couple, about 4 years ago with Cindy the first time she was on. And now Cindy tells me she might have a little more confidence to be on alone this time.
I hope so.
Well, I'm going to give her a call.
Give her a call and see what she thinks, okay? Yes. Now, if you go to North South Lake State Park, mm-hmm. you can go to the Catskill Mountain House site.
Yeah, I've been there.
And you can see, you know, the amazing view. That's still there. And the Cartersville Falls are still there. And the trails and the old carriage roads, which are now trails, are mm-hmm. still there.
Wonderful.
Okay, so it's a great place to take a vacation.
I remember my dad was a forester for NCON, mm-hmm. and we went up there several times. And so, yeah. So, all right. Well, anyway, thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate this.
Thank you for being on. And again, my guest was Cindy LaPierre of the Mountaintop Historical Society. We've been talking about the upcoming 200th anniversary of the Catskill Mountain House. And so thank you again, Cindy, for being on. And thank you all for listening. And take care and stay safe. Bye-bye.